Tonight on Arena, Houseplants, Paul Noonan and Doughy tell us about their debut album, Dry Goods, and we review Cullum Tobin's novel, The Magician, all about Thomas Mann. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Bell X1 frontman Paul Noonan guested on the 2019 album Loss from electronic producer Doughy. The song Take the Wheel marked the beginning of a musical partnership between the two. Now, the result of their lockdown venture, Houseplants, is their debut album. It's called Dry Good, which was released last Friday, and I'm delighted to be joined in studio by both Doughy and Paul. I suppose we better get the lockdown side of things out of the way, because, I mean, both Houseplants, the name itself, Paul, I guess, and the lead single, which we spoke about at the time it was released, kind of refer directly to this that moment, don't they? The lockdown.
Yeah, and while it is a lockdown record, and it's something that we've joked about during the making of, that, geez, the world won't need another lockdown record by the time this comes out.
Yeah.
We found that to lean into that idea, but we wanted it to be a defiant, positive thing that spoke to the sort of communal, joyous experiences that we were missing. And to take a lighter take on it, I suppose.
Yeah, because when it started out, where were you at a moment when lockdown was even a mention, when you started working together, or were we far away from that, Dan?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we were thinking back to it the last day. Like, the last time we had seen each other was for the Choice Awards. We played Take the Wheel for the Choice Awards. And at that point, the pandemic was only just a kind of a thing that was happening somewhere else. And everyone was like, God, wouldn't it be mad if, like, it stopped the entire music industry or something like that?
Yeah,
and then,
yeah,
like, cut to, like, 2 or 3 weeks later and suddenly everybody's stuck in their houses. Like,
yeah.
And I think, so Paul, basically, we kind of started getting in touch just to kind of see how everybody was, because, you know, the thing about being a musician, like, is your social kind of life is built around going to gigs and seeing people in different places and everything like that. So there was a kind of a concerted effort to go and actually talk to each other. And that's when Paul sent me the kind of the very early demo of one of the first tracks, which was Companero.
Yeah, so, and it must have been a good experience then, the Take the Wheel experience, Paul.
It was. I mean, while this record is very different to Take the Wheel, it was such a lovely, natural, organic collaboration. And I reached out to Doughy again with some more material in the hope that we might sort of dream it up again. Yeah, for sure.
Mm. Now, we played and spoke about What's With All the Pine, which was a direct reference to the Zoom moment when you're going, look at your man's house or your woman's house. Loads of pine in it. So I think we've done that. But I kind of wondered what window pane, which is just, it has the same feel of it to me in some ways, that we're looking into somebody's house or life.
Yeah. Yes, and it really only dawned on me when I had to explain the song to the people who made the music video. I was writing an email about the song, and then I realised, oh my God, it's a COVID banger. Because yeah, I suppose that notion of hearing sounds, humans moving around next door to you or outside, and we were all quite atomized in deep dark lockdown. I suppose that we couldn't have sort of proper contact.
And potentially a COVID banger is, of course, an impossibility, because there would have been no dancing going on, possibly in the privacy of your own home by yourself.
I was definitely dancing by myself on my own, for sure. Well, I had to keep it up. Like,
one or other of you were, or possibly both separately, when this was written, to my ears anyway. Let's have a listen to Window.
And I can hear your eyes, they're rolling out loud, they're rolling out loud. Look at this here window pane. I can breathe some breath and write your name. Look at this here window pane. I can breathe some breath and write your name.
Well, little bit there of Windowpane from Houseplants and their new album, Dry Goods. Yes, Dahi, for sure. Dahi, yes. And Paul Noonan, the two involved in Houseplants. For sure, there was a bit of dancing going on there. It wasn't over-energetic. It's quite a laid-back kind of beat to it, really, isn't there?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of a very different, a sound process that it would have to the normal Dahi stuff, you know, the Dahi music is all about kind of building ambience and very kind of like energetic moments that build up and build up. Whereas this is a much more of a kind of a groove, and you'll hear a lot more in this record. There's kind of like live drums, which are played by Paul, and a lot of live instruments like piano and stuff as well, you know?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the piano there. I was saying to Paul as we were listening to that, I really noticed as I listened across the album today, the piano is there. It's there quite a lot, actually. Did you do a lot of the work, your side of things, at the piano? Was that an initial starting point?
I did, and I was lucky enough to have use of a writing room in the National Concert Hall, and I have Dave Geraghty from BelX1. His old family piano lives up there, and it's amazing to have that connection as well. The piano that Dave learned to play on is now in my writing room, and we have this sort of connection
That's an incredible connection. And it also says, why is he doing a music project? What's wrong with BelX1? There's nothing wrong with BelX1. They're still friends. No. They play each other's piano. What kind of feeling is there around that? That you know that it's connected to Dave and his family. Yeah. So intimate, and you'd know each other for a long time.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Yeah, since, you know, that's a very formative, you know, we met in our late teens in our first band, and it's such a powerful formative time that, you know, that. And it's been a journey since, you know. The band is, I suppose, has become a hub from which all kinds of things have sprung. You know, Dave has had a number of different projects, and I think it's the sort of the way of the modern musician. You have to throw yourself into these things when they come along.
And maybe even a few BelX1 songs must have been tinkled out of that.
Oh, for sure,
piano,
you know, they have, yeah.
Along the way, which you may have heard as a BelX1 fan, not absolutely knowing, Dahi, that you were going to one day make an album with Paul.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have a very distinct memory of coming back from a Gaeltacht when I was like 17. And I went into a Shivago and bought two records from a band I'd never heard of before, which was BelX1. And BelX1 have like such an amazing kind of history in Ireland and stuff as well. And it's one of the really, really amazing things about it. And like Paul was one of the first people on my list when I wanted to write with vocalists, because I kind of always feel that like some of Paul's writings have this amazing kind of a way of taking an Irish phrase and making it really kind of profound. And that style of songwriting is really, really gets me going. So, yeah, it was great.
So when it came to that, we mentioned, you know, that we had Take the Wheel. But when it came to that, I think Campanero, which you mentioned, was the big first collaboration for this album. What was the balance between the two styles, just in the approach to this song in particular, Di? Or you're looking over at Paul.
Well, yeah, it started out with you, right?
I had a demo of the song that I'd kind of written in the wake of the marriage equality referendum. And I remember being in town on the day that the results came out, and there was such a sort of sense of euphoria about that day. And I wanted to, I suppose, speak to that with the song. But it was in a very sort of rough demo form, but it had that sort of pulse and that very frenetic quality. And I'd seen, getting to know Dahi's music through working with him, and then seeing Dahi play, I knew he is a master of that sort of four to the floor stomp thing. Yeah. So we traded emails on it, and he stripped out a lot of the parts and put his own stamp on it, and that's been the way.
Yeah, well, the foot to the floor stomp is certainly there at the beginning. Now, I always hear something new when I come down here and I have the big speakers. Oh, that's there, because while my equipment at home is good, it ain't the speakers that I have in here. Do I hear a kind of a crowd ambience in the background here?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, as soon as I kind of heard the song and the lyrics, there was just a very clear kind of memory of that day when the marriage referendum came through, and it was just such a euphoric time. Everybody was so built up, and it was, I don't know, like we did a music video for it, and the first thing that the director Alan Quigley kind of came up with was just like, it just sounds like somebody's like cycling downhill into Dublin as fast as possible. And that's what we made the video from as well. It's just all about that like incredible emotion of kind of happiness, and that like everybody's together doing this one kind of celebration.
So the ambience in the background is the
so I got a crowd audience in and just like dropped it in on my own in lockdown.
Let's have a listen.
The sun came up, streets and the houses, swollen with the tide of change, rolling on the crest of a wave. There is a love that dares to speak its name. It's our own earth, it sees our name.
And of course, the little quote in from Oscar Wilde in the midst of all of theirs, the love that dare not speak its name, Houseplants and Campanero, and Paul Noonan Doughty and Doughty O'Droney with me in studio this evening. I was saying as I was listening to that, Paul, the voice is still in good order. You seem to take care of it, and then you were kind of putting me a little bit right on that score.
I was just saying that I feel I've lost some of the higher notes. There's been a couple of songs we've been doing lately with Bell X1 that have been like, lads, can we take this down? Take this down a key or two.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a scary thing sometimes when you do lose part of your voice, because it's not like breaking a string or a drumstick.
Yeah,
you not a whole lot you can do about
it. Yeah, you can't replace the vocal cord. If it goes, kind of thing, yeah. And I suppose inevitably the range, just as time moves on, the range begins to just narrow down a little bit. But in terms of that song and in terms of working with Paul on it, was this one of the ones where you were waiting for ages for him to come back to you or not?
I think you were probably waiting first. See, I had that main synth I spent a long, long time on. Mm. My poor partner had to sit in the next room of an apartment while listening to that synth continuously moving up and down on a synth for 2 or 3 days, trying to get it just exactly right. It's funny, it's all about like distortion with Houseplants. It's like a lot of, like you kind of have to bring volumes up at a really, really high level to get this real textury sound on the synths and stuff. And then after that, I mean, the drums were played by Paul actually, and like a big, like proper, like acoustic drum sound as well that's dropped in underneath. So feels like a band. That's the big push, you know.
Which doesn't answer my question. when were the moments when you were sitting, waiting? I'd send that off to Paul now. Week goes by.
Yeah, you get the
10
panic.
10 days go by.
No, I don't think we did. We weren't sort of ghosting each other. Like, no, I hope.
No, I don't think so.
I remember it. It's a really fond memory of that time, even in deep, dark lockdown, where my phone would go and I'd have this sort of Pavlovian reaction. I'd go, oh, is that Doughty? With something new and exciting to listen to. And it would be, and I'd stick on the headphones and take the dog for a walk, and I'd dream up my response and get in the studio and you know, it was a lovely thing to lean into in those months, and the fact that we were both in our respective caves, making this music, which is for big crowds and which is for communal experience, and had to make that leap. I suppose it was the trickiest thing.
And you were saying as we were listening to Campanero there, Doughty, that you have had an occasion to play that live, have you?
Yeah, so we played our third show, I guess, this
weekend.
We're
still not at huge numbers though yet, are we?
No, we're not too. Yeah, so we played It Takes a Village, which is a festival down in Cork, and it was kind of pretty much the first time that we had a really proper standing crowd, and even then it wasn't like a giant massive audience, but like, God, you can feel it in the room. And, you know, we have a live drummer and a bassist, and Sinead White is playing piano as well. And it just feels like this really, really powerful thing. And there's such a positivity about live music right now. It's a really fantastic time to play because just everybody is just so ready for it. You know,
yeah, and both collectively as Houseplants, separately as Doughty and Paul of Bell X1, 2022, you're just dying to get back out there with live shows for each of the two that you can be involved in.
Yeah,
and Bell X1, Paul.
It feels that there's this sort of pent up energy. There's going to be a letting of sorts where people have the opportunity to get together again and enjoy gigs. Yeah.
So are there plans afoot?
For sure, yeah. Bell X1 are doing a tour with Dowry Strings, Aina Brennan, amazing musician and composer, and that's been bounced. It was supposed to happen March 2020. It's now March 2022. So it'll happen then, thankfully. And then I think we'll have a really busy summer with festivals with Houseplants. Yeah.
Yeah. And it'll be both Houseplants for you, Doughty, and Doughty.
Yeah.
Will Doughty be out and about as well?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, it's both great and extremely busy to be doing these things where we have like, you know, 4 or 5 acts going at the same time. But yeah, the Doughty stuff is coming up forward as well. And we'll be releasing singles kind of later in the year too.
Meant to ask about Dry Goods, the title. Are we in lockdown mode? Did you finally open up the press? and go, you know what? You see these pulses that I've had for 4.5 years? I'm going to get rid of them.
You've been finding a lockdown angle with everything.
That's what dry goods are for me. What are they for you?
I suppose it's, it refers to the sort of how we imagine the palette for this record shrinking and not being wet, not having a lot of reverb or atmospherics or sort of an ethereal quality, that it had this sort of organic, slightly ragged, distorted, bone dry quality.
And too many bean stews during that as well. Mannequin, I just love the kind of concept behind this as we're heading in to listen to it, Paul. The normally voiceless mannequin is given voice here.
Yeah, it's I suppose one of the more theatrical songs on the record, and it's been one again that's been kicking around for a while. Bell X1 had a day off once in Gary, Indiana, which is a very grim town in Indiana in the States. It's sort of straight out of Central Casting, deserted streets and shop fronts and. It was just a very evocative place, and I remember these mannequins that were sadly abandoned, but yet sort of were still striking these elegant poses in the windows.
Oh, there'll be a play out here, or a film out here, yes, or a short story. Well, that's what songs are really, aren't they? They're kind of
for
short
sure,
stories.
Yeah.
Let's finish up. Great to have both of you in and speaking with us this evening. Paul Noonan and Doughy, also known as Houseplants, or collectively known as Houseplants. Debut album Dry Goods is out now. This is the second single, is it, Mannequin? Or is it?
It's not out.
No, yes. not out. On the album. On the album.
It's on the album. It's not one of the singles, but there you go.
I'm a mannequin. Just waving and smiling, I'm a mannequin, not wearing a stitch. My handbag hanging from my broken wrist. I'm a mannequin, I'm yellowed by the sun. These leaves long withered, these doors too warped to close. I'm a mannequin, I'm hanging up my spurs. Oh, how the sea rages and how the fire burns.
Mannequin, the title of that song from Houseplants and their new album Dry Goods, which is out now. Colm Tobin's novel The Magician is one of the most anticipated works of fiction this year. Its subject is Thomas Mann, the Nobel Prize-winning author of The Magic Mountain and Death in Venice, a writer of international standing, forced to flee Germany in 1933 as the Nazis came to power. Mann was a father of six, married to the daughter of a wealthy Jewish family, but he also hid other longings and his desire towards his own gender. Tobin explores Mann's life between 1891 and 1950 and the fate of Europe and America in those decades, an era marked, of course, by two world wars and a Great Depression. John Self has been reading The Magician for us, and he joins me now. The novel opens, John, in 1891 in Lübeck, a provincial city on the North German coast, not far from Hamburg. Mann, at this stage, a 16-year-old, what kind of family has he grown up in?
Well, it came from a very, very respectable family. You know, one phrase that is used maybe with some irony is one of the most significant families in Lübeck. His mother was a Brazilian, but his father was a real traditional German patriarch. You know, he was a businessman. He was a senator. He considered himself to be of very great importance, but he was a cold and distant man. And the way Tobin shows this is the father, he says nothing at all in the book while the family buzzes around him until his deathbed. When he finally speaks, his dying words, which are addressed to Thomas, are, "You know nothing." And he cuts Thomas out of his will by not leaving the business to him, and that kind of sets Thomas up for this life of you know, nervousness about his own status.
Yeah, and you can understand how that might lead to his own his own doubts around his own work, etc., etc. But just to clarify what Colm Tobin is doing in the book overall, what's the relation? Yeah, are we talking about biography? Are we talking about fiction? Are we talking about a mixture of the two? What exactly is the book?
It's a novel. It's not a biography. You know, it's based very closely on his lives. I mean, Tobin says he had the idea for it when he had to read three books about Mann for an article he was writing about 15 years ago. So it's very closely based on the facts. But, you know, obviously the dialogue is invented. The emotional man's emotional life is invented, and it sort of it manages to merge all of man's experiences with what was happening in the world at the time, and sort of bring in bigger issues about sexuality and the position of the writer in society and things like that. So it makes it a very successful, I guess, blend of novel and biography.
So in some ways, it's like there are imagined scenes, if you like, but the detail around the people, the places, the times, the events, the world events, certainly, all of that is historically accurate.
Exactly, as far as we know, yes. I mean, and Tobin, you know, man's diaries, he left diaries, which Tobin drew on as well, so yeah.
And those diaries, in fact, could well have caused man, they could have got him into a lot of trouble. What kind of content did they have that would have been problematic for fascist Germany at the time?
Well, they went into great detail about his desires, which were primarily for handsome, mostly younger men. He was very concerned that the diaries, as Tobin puts it, he was, whenever he had to flee Germany and the diaries were still in Germany, he was worried that the Nazis would publish them and ruin him, you know, that they would show what he called his base sexual desires. But actually, diaries were important to him too, because in a sense, because his, you know, these desires for men, they never really came to anything, with very few exceptions. So they actually, writing them down in the diary made them solid for him and made them real for him. So it was actually important for him to do that recording.
And does Tobin then give us direct, transcriptions of the diaries, or how are the diaries referred to and handled in the novel?
Well, no, he doesn't give us direct transcriptions. In fact, that's one of the interesting things about the books, is that all of the sort of the major stuff, you know, the books, the writing of the books themselves, the diaries, the major events, the deaths, the marriages, the births, they're all happening off stage. So what we get is a kind of a background, you know, sort of behind the scenes, if there's a play of Thomas Mann's public life going on and we can't actually see it, we're behind the scenes seeing all of the background in it. So no, we don't get direct quotes from the diaries. It's much more of a sort of an impressionistic version than that.
So, for example, I mean, you mentioned this, you know, that the diaries contain references to desires, particularly for handsome and younger men. We think fairly quickly of death in Venice. We're even talking about essentially a young boy or a teenager in the case of that piece of fiction.
Yep.
How is that referred to in the novel, or how are the other works referred to in the novel? Are they offstage events as you've described them there, or do we get into the nitty-gritty of that in any way?
Well, the novels themselves are offstage events, but what we find is that almost all of his novels were very strongly inspired by life. All of his fiction was inspired by what happened to him. So this, the boy, you know, Tadzio and Death in Venice, was inspired by this adolescent boy that he saw whenever the family were on holiday. And in fact, Thomas was very, very happy whenever this adolescent boy's family befriended the Mann family, and he was able to spend more time, you know, just observing him. He disguised himself somewhat as a dying composer by creating Aschenbach in the novel, but it was a very thin disguise. So that story is very strongly based on Mann's own experiences.
And this sounds very similar to the technique and the way in which Colm Tobin wrote his novel of 2004, Exploring the World of Henry James, the Master. Is it very much, if you know that novel, are we in a similar world, albeit a similar literary world, albeit we're in a totally different period of time and a totally different location?
Yeah, it's similar. I mean, I would describe the books as probably cousins rather than siblings, you know, because that was a terrific book as well, but it was more restricted in scope than The Magician. You know, I think it covered maybe 4 or 5 years in the life of Henry James at a time whenever he saw as a period of failure for him. But there's certainly a similar interiority, whereas the Mann book covers, you know, what, 60 years? And a similar theme, of course, of suppressed homosexuality, although with James, that was much more speculation on Tobin's part than in Mann, where it's actually recorded.
Yeah. Now, the other aspect of this novel in particular, The Magician from Colm Tobin, and in fact Mann's own life, is his extraordinary marriage to Katja Pringsheim, if I'm saying her surname correctly there. She came from quite the family, really, didn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. And there was, I mean, you know, we've talked about Mann's, you know, sexual desires, and there was an awful lot of, you know, there are question marks hinted at in the book and in biography about, you know, some incestuous relationships in Katja's family. So it was a very progressive modern family that he married into, which is quite a contrast for his very stiff, upright. I mean, you just have to, if you Google a picture of Thomas Mann, you'll see he's a very patrician figure, a very buttoned-up figure. His marriage to his wife, and then that gave rise to these children who again were able to express themselves in a way that he wasn't.
And how does Katja come across in the novel? What kind of, because she essentially, since we're in the world of a novel, she does become a character as opposed to an historical person, if you like.
she does become a character. Yes, I mean, she's faithful to Thomas. You know, we don't get any clear indication that she knows about what's going on in his mind. But she she stands up for him too. You know, and she whenever the children are challenging them about the fact that some events that they like a funeral that they didn't go to, she stands up for Thomas and she argues with the children on his behalf.
The children themselves, interestingly, there are, is it three writers in total amongst the children, and certainly three members, or three of the six children whose sexuality, there's bisexuality in some cases and homosexuality in other cases. Is it those three children really who are concentrated upon in the book?
There are probably two that are concentrated on mostly, which are the two eldest, Klaus and Erica.
Erica, yeah.
They were the most famous of his children anyway, in the sense that and Thomas would sort of be slightly despairing of what he called their appetite for fame, their open bisexuality, their notoriety. But he could also see that he was actually slightly envious of what they were able to do that he had never been able to do. And Erica, for example, she was a lesbian, but she married W.H. Auden, who was the gay British poet, so that she could get British citizenship whenever her German citizenship was cancelled. Klaus, he went on, as you said, to become a writer as well. He then took his own life. The youngest son, Michael, he took his own life as well. So there was tragedy, and there was a lot of stuff going on there.
And all of that material, that makes its way into The Magician?
It does, yes. I mean, if you wanted to put a make a criticism of the book, it's the stuff maybe in the second half, towards the second end of the Second World War and afterwards is a little bit slow, but then you get all of these sort of very sort of dramatic events and things happening. Mm. So it certainly keeps the pages turning in that sense.
That, in if you like, is in that that's the private side of this very public man. What about the public side? There was huge pressure on him at the time to denounce Hitler and to be, if you like, a voice of anti-fascism. What do we get dealing with that aspect of man's own character and that public aspect of his life?
Well, I mean, that's the other great conflict in the book for him. His sexuality is one, and then the public figure is the other one, because he, during the First World War, he argued with his brother Heinrich, another writer, he was very nationalistic. Thomas was very pro-Germany and argued in favour of Germany and spoke in favour of Germany. Whenever they lost the war, he felt sort of as if he was humiliated, and he dithered a lot about whether or not to denounce Hitler and the Nazis. He didn't really know what to do. He made speeches. He was heckled by Nazi supporters. He was embarrassed by that, a man of his stature. And then it wasn't until the war was declared in 1939 that he actually broke his silence and started to make the interventions that he should have made long before.
Well, we must remember that his wife was a Jew, and therefore, and his own homosexuality would have placed him in great danger too. I suppose those are important details. Let's listen to Mann himself in a recording here from the BBC from 1942.
Ladies and gentlemen, this country has an earnest desire to find the truth behind the news, to learn the inside story of momentous events. It even has institutions solely devoted to the exposure of foreign propaganda. Well, then, what is the inside story of anti-Semitism? For let none of my listeners deceive himself, this special form of racial hatred does not confine itself to the unspeakable horrors which it is producing on a scale putting all previous atrocities in the shade. Oh no, the anti-Semitism of today, the efficient though artificial anti-Semitism of our technical age, is no object in itself. It is nothing but a wrench to unscrew, bit by bit, the whole machinery of our civilization. Or, to use an up-to-date simile, anti-Semitism is like a hand grenade tossed over the wall to work havoc and confusion in the camp of democracy. That is its real and main purpose.
That's the voice there of Thomas Mann from a BBC recording made in 1942. This evening, John Self is with me speaking about Colm Tobin's new novel, The Magician, dealing with the life of Thomas Mann, or 60 years in that life. It's a novel rather than a biography of the man. The truth behind the news is one of the things that Mann says in the first or second sentence of that clip, John. To what extent do you think is Colm Tobin here writing about the fascism and the anti-fascism of 1930s Europe and drawing direct parallels to today?
Well, I mean, it's impossible to read the book and not see some parallels. You know, whenever Thomas, as he's called, he's always referred to as Thomas in the book, whenever Thomas is heckled at public events, or whenever Tobin describes the Nazis as acting as both government and opposition, I mean, those both sound very familiar to anyone who's experienced the last few years in certain administrations. But at the same time, it may be that that's less because of specific people that we've experienced than because such sentiments and such organizations will always be with us and always arise time and time again.
Mann himself, by the way, he wrote in German. He wrote it despite the fact his English clearly there is perfectly good.
He learned English actually, and that's part of the book as well. He found it very difficult. I don't know in that recording whether or not he was actually writing his own words, as it were, or reading out words that he'd learned. But yeah, he did learn English.
But the original novels are in German, so
we
get them in translation here. What about Tobin's prose in the case of The Magician? Does it emulate or does it have echoes of Mann's prose in any way?
I wouldn't say it echoes Mann's prose, which is tend to be quite sort of long sentences and quite ornate, but it's quiet and sober and restrained. I mean, that partly reflects Mann's character, but it also, to be honest, reflects how Tobin writes in his other books. But I suppose that restraint means that whenever there is some emotion on display, it hits you like a smack in the mouth. You know, there's a scene where Thomas, he's in his late 40s at the time, he's at his mother's funeral. His daughter Erica, who's in her late teens, says to him, "I've never seen you crying before." And he just says, "I will stop crying soon."
I can see where that would smack you. The restraint of it, right enough. Where do you place this novel, The Magician, in terms of Colm Tobin's work? And are you recommending it for us, John?
I am indeed. I mean, I put it, before this, The Master was my favourite of his books. And I was hoping he would do something as ambitious and as satisfying as The Master. And I think he's actually surpassed it. It's definitely up there among my favourite of his books. And certainly my favourite, one of the two of the favourites of my books I've read this year.
So no caveats, or it sounds very few caveats really in your mind there, John.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's John Self speaking to us about The Magician by Colm Tobin. It's published this Thursday, 23rd of September by Viking. Foundation is a new 10-part television series based on the influential sci-fi novels of Isaac Asimov. The series stars Jared Harris as a mathematician who predicts the downfall of a galactic empire. It launches this Friday on Apple TV Plus, and it's the first time that Asimov's Foundation stories have been brought to the screen. Taken a long time to get them there, and a multi-million-dollar budget to bring the stories to us. Chris Wasser is with us this evening to tell us about the source material and some of the difficulties that might be involved in bringing such source material to the screen. Let's start with Asimov himself and the Foundation novels. Fit the Foundation novels into Asimov's overall sci-fi work, Chris, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, Isaac Asimov, one of the most influential American sci-fi authors that ever lived. He was one of, you know, the big few kind of hard sci-fi authors. You definitely put him up there with Arthur C. Clarke, who gave us 2001 Space Odyssey. And he was also a professor of biochemistry, and all of his work kind of incorporated, you know, real scientific elements and an awful lot of real life history to create something that wasn't just, you know, Star Wars. I mean, Foundation actually had an awful, you know, a huge impact and a huge influence on George Lucas' Star Wars. But, you know, all of this, the short stories that Asimov wrote, there was always something logical to them. There was always something real to them. And he actually, over his career, he died in 1992. And over his expansive career, he gave us more than 500 books. And I've been trying to actually figure out how someone could possibly publish that many while also publishing, you know, 300 odd short stories and essays and letters. And most of them, you know, a lot of them were books about physics and chemistry. A lot of them were science fiction novels. A lot of them were mysteries. But the big series was Foundation. So this actually started life in the 1940s for the Astounding Science Fiction magazine, then published into a trilogy of books, and he later added on to them.
So did it start literally as a story or two that just grew and grew and grew?
It started as a short story, originally published in a monthly magazine, Astounding Science Fiction, published in 1944 in America. And it just, yeah, it had legs and there was something there. And I think it was the fact that he wanted to create something that was both a response to World War II, but also, what if you took something like the fall of the Roman Empire and what if you put it in space? And what if you took something that was, you know, this huge moment in history and make it even bigger? So the world of Foundation, you're talking about, it's set in kind of, you know, it's set in this interstellar galactic empire. There are millions of planets. It's set, you know, 7,000, 8,000 years into the future. And it does essentially involve the fall of an empire, and also a mathematician named Harry Sheldon, who predicts, he creates this form of mathematics called psychohistory. And it basically looks at sociological and historical changes in population growth and all that stuff. And he predicts that this empire will fall and the emperor's kind of reaction to this.
Now, was Asimov, you think, actually predicting this kind of event? You know, maybe not the specifics of it, but was he essentially saying, lads, we're heading on this course if we don't watch out?
In one sense, it is. It's convenient to think that Asimov was kind of thinking, lads, this will happen again. And this is, you know, if a mathematician was to turn around right now and say, this world will fall, and it will fall in the next 50 years, and then we will enter a dark age for 1,000 years, as the way Harry Sheldon does in Foundation, what sort of response it would get. And it was interesting for Asimov to write. And although the story is quite dense, an awful lot of the actual writing was very accessible in Asimov's work. I mean, a lot of it was told through dialogue. But it takes a look at some fascinating theories that if you tell a population that something bad is going to happen, do they then make it happen as a result of you telling them that?
Self-fulfilling prophecy type of thing. Let's have a listen to Asimov speaking to David Letterman in 1980, all around the whole idea of, is he writing predictions? Is he writing fiction?
Have you ever written about things and then seen them come true?
Occasionally, yes. I described a spacewalk in 1952. And when they did it, some years later, it turned out to be exactly the way I described it. It wasn't very difficult. I described pocket computers in 1950, got the appearance exactly right. I talked about space stations getting energy down to Earth in 1940 and got that almost right. I put it in Mercury's orbit instead of the Moon's orbit to get it closer to the Sun. Maybe someday we'll do that. Mm-hmm. I predicted there'd be opposition to the space race. And there was. But these are little things. I never tried to predict. I just tried to write stories that would sell so I could pay my way through college.
Do you know, if you're asking Isaac Asimov a question, you'd want to know how to follow up what you're going to ask him afterwards.
Definitely.
Astonishing how he kind of does say, I predicted lots of things that we know have happened since then, since 1980 and before it.
He also had a very New York sense of humour, and he could be quite deadpan at times. And I think also in that interview, he is asked about, you know, what's your favourite subject? And he says, me. I mean, and what else do you do? I don't do anything else. That's how he had managed at that time to write close to 300 books. A lot of people have looked into Foundation as a sort of, you know, what's Asimov trying to say here? At the same time, you know, it's easy to get carried away with that. He was trying to tell this fascinating science fiction story. And it's interesting that, you know, it was originally published in magazine form in the 1940s. For 50, 60 years, no one has been able to film this thing. Because it tells its story over 1,000 years.
That's what I was going to ask you. So you mentioned it growing from one story to several stories and several novels as a result. 1,000 year span.
Yeah.
That's a big task to transfer to the screen. Who is brave stroke foolhardy enough to take on such a task?
Yeah, the man bringing it to the screen, he originally started working with Josh Friedman, but it's mostly been David S. Goyer's project. So Goyer is probably best known for working as a screenwriter and filmmaker on some of the biggest comic book movies over the last 20 years. So worked on the Blade trilogy with Marvel and then jumped ship to DC, working on the Dark Knight trilogy with Chris Nolan, the Superman Man of Steel films. Has had enormous success as a screenwriter, but less so as a kind of creator or a showrunner of his own show. And the story goes that he was working on a new Terminator film with James Cameron when he got a call to say that Foundation, which he had said before in countless interviews, one of the most influential science fiction stories to millions of people around the world, but to him as a cinematic storyteller. And he got this call to say, Foundation, the rights are up for grabs. Do you want to take this on? Do you want to work with Apple on this? And he said it to James Cameron, and James Cameron said, That sounds very tricky, because it is this thousand-year story. David Esquire was used to making these, you know, trilogies. He thought, what if I tell this story over potentially 8 years of television? So that's his plan going forward, to make 8 years worth of television about this, because he thinks, and I do as well, that's potentially the only way to tell this story.
And I guess if you've already, as Apple have, ploughed multi-millions of dollars into the production, you're gonna stick with it for a little while before you say that's not working.
Yes.
Do we know how many seasons, or have they even said that yet?
This first season has taken 4 to 5 years to get off the ground. So depending on how viewers respond to it and critics, I say, I'm not sure. You know, David Goyer has kind of, you know, kept a very tight lipped about whether or not to be a second or third season, but has said that if the response is good, he is in this for the long haul. And also interesting that this is not just one of the biggest productions that Apple TV Plus has worked on. It's also one of the biggest productions to have ever been filmed in Ireland, because David Esquire,
this is amazing that it was actually made in Troy Studios in Limerick.
That's it. Yeah, they came over just before the pandemic, and then obviously when everything went sideways, it made the production a bit of a nightmare, as every other production has experienced in the recent 2 years. 500 people were employed on this. If you listen carefully throughout the production, we can't quite talk about the show just yet, but there are quite a few Irish accents in there.
We can talk about the Limerick connection for
we
sure.
We can, yeah. Shot in Troy Studios in Limerick. They also went to Iceland at one stage. I think they were in Cyprus. But yeah, most of the production did take place in Ireland over 8 to 9 months. And again, a multi-million dollar production. I think it's the biggest thing that's ever been filmed here.
Yeah, Jared Harris is the big Limerick connection as well. But obviously, son of the great Richard Harris.
It's been so great in these past few years to see Jared Harris finally come into his own as an actor, and not just, you know, living in his father's shadow, because Jared Harris over the last 10 to 12 years has actually featured in 4 of the biggest television productions of all time. I mean, he played King George the VI in The Crown, bringing great humanity and charm to the king, I must say. He played the brilliant Liam Price in Mad Men, played Vagery Leskalov, I think his name is, the chemist at the heart, the lead in Chernobyl, and also played an Irish sailor in the nautical horror, The Terror. Amazing work. I think the best thing that has happened to Jared Harris is that he's actually gotten older, and, you know, casting agents and producers kind of see his worth as a brilliant character actor. So he is the lead here. He is playing the mathematician who predicts basically, you know, the end of the galaxy as we know it. And I think that's a mark of quality, that when you see his name, when you see him involved in something, you know it's going to be worth your time.
But going back to Asimov, he wouldn't have a reputation as the most, how should we put it, diverse of writers. Diversity does not play large in his list of characters.
No, back in the 1940s, the stories he was writing, they were predominantly for what he believed, and what, you know, other readers might have believed was a male fan base, but it wasn't. Women were reading sci-fi, and he wrote an awful lot of male characters, and any female characters that he wrote, they were very poor. They were just sketches on the page there to support and, you know, big up the male characters. So when David Esquire, and it's the same, this is also the sci-fi writer behind the iRobot series. So it's been the same whenever the work has been adapted, that, you know, screenwriters and filmmakers have introduced female characters. So David Esquire has basically made the other main character, Gail Dornick, played by Lou LaBelle here, originally a male character in the books, thought, no, there has to be more female characters here. So it is quite a diverse cast of, you know, white male actors, African-American female actors. There is a bigger push now, because you would not have gotten away with creating a television show based purely on what was on Asimov's page.
And that obviously would be one set of challenges for this adaptation. I guess that's there in a lot of science fiction, or if you're taking anything written in the early part of the 20th century, you're going to have to address that. Are there other challenges, not least of which I'm wondering is, you know, the fact that there's quite a lot of philosophy in Asimov's writing.
Yes.
How do we get that into a television series where, you know, you're trying to keep the viewer rather than bore them with a philosophy lecture?
Yeah, there is an awful lot in there. But actually, David Esquire has doubled down as well, because he says that, you know, part of the reason that he is such a fan of Asimov's writing is that it does reflect, you know, Asimov was always holding up a mirror, he says, to what was going on in the real world. It wasn't just fantastical space opera stuff. This is real hard sci-fi. So it's been important to him to kind of, you know, draw parallels to what's actually happening in the world. And we do see, we're allowed to say this, that in the opening installments, you are seeing people fleeing their home planets because they are trying to tell, you know, the population that climate change is real, that the seas are rising for a reason, and that there has to be, you know, we have to kind of change our behavior in order to save the world. We're looking at this and kind of thinking, well, you know, look, they're getting it wrong 8,000 years in the future too. So it was important for Gordon not to just create, you know, a flashy piece of entertainment. There has to be something in there, because Asimov was always, you know, keen to actually, you know, make his science fiction feel real.
And we will find out all when the first two episodes of Foundation are available this Friday on Apple TV Plus. Are you excited and waiting with bated breath?
I am excited, yeah. I mean, this thing has taken 60, 70 years to get off the ground, so hopefully it's good.
Thank you very much to Chris Wasser for that. Hi, Sean, says this text. Enjoying your interview about Isaac Asimov and his Foundation. One of my favourite authors. He had a sense of humour too, and he has brought out a book of, quote, lecherous limericks too, says Michael in Ennis. He doesn't tell me, Michael, whether there's a television series planned on lecherous limericks or not. Maybe we'll have you in.
No, we might have to wait another 60 years for that.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for that, Chris Wasser, and indeed Michael in Ennis. That is our lot for this Tuesday evening on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening in tonight's programme, produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night at 7.